Greenside, the IGA podcast.
Also, Mike McCoy, the 2013 U.S.
Zach Johnson, now a two-time major champion after becoming the winner of the 144th Open Championship.
Welcome back to Greenside, the IGA podcast. We're going to continue our discussion with the USGA's Joe Foley, Regional Director of Affairs in the Midwest region.
Joe, obviously, the last 2 years in, in the golf world as well as everywhere else, it's been just turned upside down. 2020, we're not sure, what's going to happen, obviously, with the championships of the USGA, all but just a couple were held. Back to your 14 championship schedule, can you just talk about kind of the last couple years for maybe you personally, and then maybe kind of an overview of the USGA of maybe how you've been able to kind of turn a bad situation into maybe growth for the game and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it has been a bit of a wild ride, but I think in a positive way, certainly for the game. It was a game that, people realized and recognized pretty early on during the pandemic that it was one of the outlets, right, that a lot of people had, that they were either already an avid golfer and were able to play more golf or exposed to the sport because they weren't able to do other activities and jumped in and enjoyed it. Right. So I think we've seen the wave, recognized the wave. I don't know if we can take a lot of credit for it because it sort of happened organically, over the course of the last few years. I will say that I think one of the benefits, positives that we helped contribute in to, I would say at the beginning of the pandemic, and then also with a ton of your help locally, was the framework that was put together called Back to Golf, where, there were protocols that were put in place pretty quickly based upon sort of alignment that the industry had, both at the recreational level and the competitive level, that really allowed golfers to sort of come back to the game and do it safely. And that all kind of happened, I would say, over the course of that early part of maybe the spring into summer of 2020. And it sort of took place at the national level, but then it was all rolled out. All those protocols were rolled out by associations like yourself and other organizations that really helped support the return to golf is what it was really called. So I would say that was a big big win, and I think maybe in some small way helped support the advancement of the game kind of through the pandemic. As far as on the championship level with the USGA. We only were able to conduct four championships in 2020, and we weren't having any qualifiers that were associated with those championships. And that's such a big part of USGA championships, right? There's that open feel, right, across the country that, if you have a certain handicap index and you're able to register for an event, you can qualify and you can play in a national championship, whether that's the US Open, Mid-Am, or any of our junior or amateur championships as well. And it's that, that was something that we were unfortunately not able to conduct last year, but onto this year and to your question, I mean, we were able to get back to all 14 full slates of qualifiers and it really allowed us to kind of return to the essence of USGA championships. If someone gets hot at the right time, you can jump through a qualifier and ultimately play in a national championship, really at the highest level of the game for your demographic. And it was really exciting for us to get back to that. We didn't really have any hiccups in terms of, championship interruptions this year. So we were able to conduct all those championships on time and really look forward to doing that next year and the years to come, regardless of whether the pandemic's, in play or a part of our lives. We at the USGA were able to sort of work through it and still conduct championships. And, even more importantly, you all were able to help with the qualifiers this year amid all the protocols that were in place. And that was, that was super helpful and really a blueprint for us to get through something like this down the road if we need to face something similar again.
Yeah, Joe, it's interesting because obviously the USGA canceling so many of their amateur championships and open championships last year, like you said, just holding the four, but also canceling, qualifying for all of them. A few people maybe questioned that, but the point that I think a lot of people have to understand is that you guys as the United States Golf Association were looking at it from a, okay, yeah, in Iowa, they're running tournaments and we could go probably host qualifying in Iowa, right? But in New York, it was like this, or California, they had laws like that. And for you guys to really do qualifying the way you want to do it across the country, it just wasn't going to be in the cards at all last year, was it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I would say that even sort of continued to, you know, our championships on the national level, right? You had a situation where it was probably easy to conduct, you know, X amount of our championships because of where they were located and because of the spread or the lack of spread, right? But to conduct one of our amateur championships in one part of the country, but not be able to do it in another part of the country, just based upon where the venue was being held, it didn't make a ton of sense. So yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, it was one of those things where, unfortunately, it was a little bit of all or nothing with qualifying and with our amateur championships. We did prioritize the USAM and the US Women's AM, and then also the US Open and then the US Women's Open, and we were able to make that work with a lot of efforts. So you know, there was a situation where we were able to get a few across the finish line and hand out a trophy at the end, but it was just difficult across the country to conduct all of them or conduct even a good majority of them without some consistency across the board.
Joe, USGA has a new CEO in Mike Wan. You want to just kind of comment on kind of what your relationship with him has maybe been thus far and kind of the excitement, you know, going forward with him?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little bit about Mike Davis, who committed 10 years of his life to being our CEO, and then many, many years before that on staff. And, bittersweet to see him go. As he made his way out from his post, we did introduce a new program, sort of in honor of his name. It was formerly the Turfgrass Environmental Research Program, and we renamed that program after him. Just for all the work and all the efforts, and really his interest in sort of advancing golf courses, golf course management, turf health into the future, that those research grants are sort of named after him going forward. So we appreciate all the work he did, and we're excited to welcome a new CEO. It was the right time for Mike Davis. It was the right time for the organization, and now Mike Wan has been on staff. And really at the helm, leading us forward for the last few months. He brings a ton of energy, right? A ton of energy and passion. And I think that comes through in almost all the interviews he does, all of his public appearances. I think the challenge for Mike has been, he's taken over an organization during a time where, not all of us are in the office, right? So we're still in a distributed working environment. So for him to have to learn the organization and do it in such a way when his staff, his people are spread out, I think that's made it for an interesting transition. And so I think you'll slowly hear about ways he wants to, change the USGA, both from a cultural perspective, but also, the key initiatives he's focused on. But I think he'll take a few more days, a few more months to get to know us, to get to know what he's working with from a staff and resource perspective. We're actually getting ready to go back into the office full time, more on like a, hybrid model where it'll be two to three days a week for each of our staff members who are based at the New Jersey office. So I think that'll allow him to kind of wrap his arms around our team. But look, he did so many great things at the LPGA. He led that entire organization through periods of historic growth. And I think we have high hopes for him at the USGA. He's a passionate, motivational, leader. And I think that'll be something that'll, really shine through both on an internal level, but externally. I think we'll sort of feed off that passion. And I think he'll be able to carry our organization forward on that front alone, just because he cares so deeply about the game and he wants the best for the game for the future. And I think with that mindset, you're at least setting yourself up for success. It's still going to take some time for him to learn what we do and learn how we do it. But we're all pretty excited about what's to come with Mike.
Joe, you mentioned the USGA's involvement, in turfgrass research and some other things. I think that's important for our listeners to understand that it's not just championships, it's not just handicapping, which is both those are obviously a huge part of the USGA. But Turfgrass Research, and I'll let you speak on the Deacon a little bit, but I want to get your thoughts. And I know we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast previously, the PJ Boatwright internship program, just an incredible program that actually celebrated 30 years, just an incredible program, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, a couple different things that I think people don't go to right away when they think of the USGA, you know, most think of us when it comes to the US Open and, you know, maybe some of the other things we spoke about, but there are other things we're involved in. And you called out a couple different of those initiatives. We are committed through our green section to, you know, provide tools and services to golf courses and golf facilities across the country through our course consulting program. And then also this Deacon app, which you called out there, which is essentially a facility management tool, a resource management tool that's been renamed, rebranded in honor of the late Deacon Palmer, who was Arnold Palmer's father and, you know, who was a superintendent and super important to the sort of the landscape of superintendents and that whole scene during his time on, you know, within the game. So that app, you know, again, is in service to clubs and facilities to help better understand how they're using labor, how they're using their resources. That's something that, I don't think a ton of clubs or superintendents maybe even know about that we do. And, you know, to the extent that anyone's interested, we're happy to provide that that support. And we have a group of field agronomists that are based all across the country of about 8 to 10 on staff that focus their time solely on providing those services to those clubs and facilities who look for that. So we'll continue to go forward with those programs, and particularly the Deacon app. I mean, we only have, I would say, a couple hundred customers. Think about, you know, the number of golf courses in this country, 14,000 plus, who could benefit from a resource like that, better understanding how to use their labor and their resources to make better business decisions. There's a lot of potential there. So we'll look forward to growing that, the use of that app and that tool going forward. And then on the Boatwright front, the PJ Boatwright internship dates back to 1991. We've been able to fund internships for over 3,000 individuals during that time. And those internships take place at golf associations, right? At state and regional golf associations where, you know, folks who are in college or maybe just recently graduating college have learned what it takes and what it's like to be a golf administrator. You know, we recognize that contributes to the game sort of in the, you know, the current time by allowing, you know, folks to conduct competitions through the help of those interns. But, you know, even more so, and I'd say more importantly, it's sort of building the future of folks who work at associations and in the industry, right, to support the game going forward, right? So the internship does, I think, you know, more, I'd say, in the building for the future part than just, you know, what it sort of currently serves in terms of supporting the associations on a day-to-day basis. But that program will continue next year. I think the USGA leadership team and the board believes in the importance of that program. And, you know, we'll continue to focus on that and celebrate that program in the years to come.
Hey, Joe, I got a question. The USGA, what, about a year ago, maybe, if I'm thinking about this right, announced the Pinehurst project and moving some things down there, including, I believe, the equipment testing facility and at least pieces of the Hall of Fame Museum. I guess just talk briefly about that and maybe why, when is it kind of scheduled to be finished, and maybe why, if an Iowan's down at Pinehurst or wanted to make a trip, like why would they want to visit this new USGA facility?
Yeah, so it's one of those things where if you think about where we're located now in sort of the outskirts of New York City or Philly, kind of right between those two cities, you know, in Far Hills, New Jersey, it is a bit of a remote place, right? And we have a museum there, and we have a lot going on there with our test center, but it's not a place that people necessarily just sort of naturally would go to or gravitate to in their travels. And to your point, if people are visiting or going on a golf trip, different parts of the country, it's not something that, you know, people may necessarily build their trip around, in part because it is sort of in an area that's not visited too often. Our thought with Pinehurst was, can we get to a place, both from a, you know, staff and resource perspective in terms of positioning people, can we get to a place that, you know, is a little bit more a part of the golf culture and golf industry, where, you know, we are located closer to where golfers are going and to where people are familiar, and really a place of historical significance within the game, right? Pinehurst has hosted, you know, dozens of championships and is really the cradle of American golf, right? So our thought process and our philosophy behind at least bringing part of our staff there and some of our functions is just that, right? If you were to start the USGA today, you know, no offense to New Jersey, but you probably wouldn't just pick an office, an hour and a half outside New York City in the middle of New Jersey to start the USGA. You would probably pick a hub, like a Pinehurst, you know, like a Pebble Beach, like a place like that, where there's just a little bit more of a golf culture to it. So we'll continue to have our place in New Jersey going forward. We think it's important to maintain a presence there. And we do have a museum that'll continue to stay there. But I'd say the back half of next year, you'll start to see more of a presence of the USGA in Pinehurst, North Carolina. We're going to have about 50 to 75 staff members there moving forward, working out of those offices. And then we'll host many more championships there. We've committed to Pinehurst number 2 and the whole Pinehurst Country Club as being an anchor site for the US Open and our championships going forward. And then we'll be able to take advantage of the fact that there's foot traffic there, right? So people who visit Pinehurst will be able to visit sort of a satellite museum, we'll call it, and be able to experience the test center as well. And we won't be too far away from Raleigh-Durham, which is a sort of an epicenter for innovation and science and research. So we'll be able to take advantage of those opportunities being close to Raleigh. So I think it'll be a good opportunity. It's not a full move to Pinehurst. You know, some have asked, well, does that mean the entire staff will be there? We're leaving New Jersey. No, it's just part of our staff. But we see an opportunity there going forward. And like I said, you'll start to see that more towards the end of next year. But really 2023, 2024 is when it'll kind of take shape with kind of a formal office there and a museum and the test center as well.
Joe, kind of changing gears. How much golf do you get to play yourself?
Well, it's interesting. Last year, I think along with most people, I played more during the pandemic. You know, people ask this question a lot, and I think you guys probably get it too, being in the golf industry, how much golf do you play? And, you know, my answer is I do play a good bit in my free time, but, you know, being in the industry, being in and around the game at championships, I'm not playing a lot of golf for work. And frankly, when I'm on the golf course for work, it's kind of nice, you know, in my free time to get away a little bit. But yeah, I play, look, a couple times, I'd say a couple times a month, maybe 5 to 10 times a month, depending on the time of year. You know, it's a good part of the country that I live in now. I mean, New Jersey's got a lot of good public golf kind of in the area. And then when I get to visit out to the Midwest, occasionally I'll hop out and play with folks when I'm making visits out there.
What's some of your favorite places to play, or maybe some experiences where you've only played once, but, you know, it's like, gosh, I got to get back there sometime soon.
Yeah. A couple places come to mind. I've been able to, lucky enough to play in a couple of mid-am tournaments here in the New Jersey area. The Metropolitan Golf Association mid-am was conducted last year at Somerset Hills. And then this year at Friars Head out in Long Island.
Ooh, nice.
And I'd say those two courses, I'd put them up against any of the courses I've played. I haven't played, too many of the top 100, but both those courses are two that are close to the top of my list, mainly because they're just, you know, they're great walks. You know, the routing is at both places are amazing. They're different golf courses, right? One is newer, Cork Crenshaw and Friars Head, and then you have Somerset Hills, which is a Tillinghast and you know, one of his finest. But both, you know, the takeaway for me kind of at both golf courses is that the kind of the land that they both sit on, when you're walking around, it almost feels like the only thing that was meant to be on this land is a golf course, just the way the routing and the way the holes are structured and built. just places you, you know, you could play every day and really never get tired of playing. So those two will probably stand out, I'd say.
Well, those sound like two pretty good ones, especially Friar's Head. I've heard of that one and read about that one a lot. So that's awesome.
Yeah. A lot of fun. And, you know, it's one of those things too, where out on Long Island, you roll down the street and with every 5-10 minute stint, you're going to find another top-notch golf course. So, you know, you could go through and talk about, you know, National and Shinnecock and Sabonic and Maidstone and Atlantic. I mean, courses that I actually haven't, you know, had the chance to play most of them, but it's a really rich area for golf courses. And, you know, any chance that you get to visit those areas and an invitation that comes to you, you almost can't pass those opportunities up.
For sure. Hey, Joe, since you're, I'll give you a little ribbing, I guess, but you're the Midwest Regional Director, and I'm looking at future U.S. Open sites. Country Club next year, Massachusetts, East Coast. Los Angeles Country Club, West Coast. Pinehurst, East Coast. Oakmont, East Coast. Shinnecock, East Coast. Pebble, West Coast. Marion, East Coast. Can we get a U.S. Open in your region, bud? Like, how do we go about getting something back in the Midwest? What's going on? We'd like to go, you know, here. We like to play golf here in the Midwest.
Yeah.
I am completely with you. I mean, you are preaching to the choir, Chad. It's one of those things where, you know, I think for a variety of reasons, it's sort of turned into this sort of left coast, east, right coast, west coast, east coast, alternating sites. And, you know, we, like you said, we can't forget that there's a ton of great golf, you know, both in the upper Midwest area, but also in the central parts of the country and down in Texas and, you know, areas that we frankly host other championships, but haven't hosted the U.S. Open recently. So it's a good thought. We get this question quite a bit because particularly when you think about what we're starting to announce around anchor sites, you know, we announced recently that Oakmont and Marion are going to have a place in the U.S. Open sort of rotation, if you will, going forward. And Pinehurst, as I mentioned earlier, will have a presence there as well. And I think people in the Midwest get a little fearful that if you start to build out anchor sites, well, then now you're talking about even fewer opportunities, right, for the U.S. Open to go to the Midwest. And I think it's a fair question, but I will say that there are, you know, several sites in the Midwest, and you could probably name them, you know, better than I could, of places where we have taken U.S. Opens before and that I think we're going to, you know, strongly consider here in the next couple of years as we continue to announce those sites. So I won't go out and name those clubs, you know, on the record, but I do think that we're going to leave open, you know, those years that maybe haven't been named a site yet, for a potential move to the Midwest or an opportunity in the Midwest. Or like I said, in a, you know, more of the central part of the country.
Right. And, you know, I say that knowing full well that, you know, you certainly aren't deciding these things, and it's, you know, people certainly no offense, but way above you and the staff rankings, if you will, that are kind of pulling the trigger. And it's probably more even the committee, executive committees, but it is just kind of interesting, especially with personally, I like it when the U.S. Open goes to the West Coast, because that means it's on later at night. It's easier to watch on TV for us, you know, when we work that day. So
totally,
you know, I actually get a, you know, I kind of get excited when it's out in California, just from the TV time standpoint.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things I'd add too to this is that so much of this, of these conversations around, you know, where the U.S. Open specifically goes in addition to the Women's Open, as much as the golf course is a big, you know, indicator and driver of, you know, where we take this championship, so much of it involves, you know, the infrastructure and the surrounding towns and areas, right? When you think about taking a championship to an area, you know, what is sort of the value that the entire, you know, entire area, entire place, and what is sort of the build out, the footprint that needs to take place in that area for it to be a successful Open? And so, I mean, to your point, I'm not involved in any of those processes, but it's tough because sometimes everyone just sort of thinks of the golf course itself and says, well, that's the determinant, right, of where a U.S. Open goes. And I just know that from what I've heard, there's just so many other factors that go into those decisions. And, you know, again, I think there's a couple of sites that fit the mold that I just sort of shared in the Midwest. And I'm with you guys. I'm crossing my fingers that we get one or two, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years in the area.
Well, you're exactly right, because I know when the Open was at Marina in 2013, they would talk about how financially that Open didn't do as well for the USGA, right? Because there wasn't as much room for probably corporate tents and things like that, that they, you know, the more of those that they can sell, the better it is financially for the USGA. And maybe the listeners don't know this, but I think all of us know this. It's, you know, that US Open really drives the USGA's fiscal year. Because you make money on the US Open and you pretty much spend money on everything else that you do.
Yeah, the US Open is really the only championship where we make money. And to your point, all the other programs we just, you know, spent 45 minutes talking about are really funded by that 1 week a year. And, you know, so everything that surrounds it. But if you think about all the amateur championships and really all the other opens, you know, the other opens, it's a little bit closer to break even, but some of the other championships that take place, we really wouldn't be able to conduct without the US Open. So, yeah, it's a valid point, and all that needs to be taken into account when US Open sites are selected.
For sure. So, yeah, I hope you understand. Yeah, I was definitely just kind of joking around with you about the sites, but I did like to point out that, hey, it would be nice to get something a little closer to us at some point. And there's some, like you said, there's a few open years coming up. So maybe we get lucky and we see something at Oakland Hills or who knows where else, you know.
Don't you worry, though. I mean, what you're saying to me, I'm kind of sharing also on my end, too, with the internal folks.
Well, yeah,
folks.
You want it, right?
I want it, too.
You're the regional guy, yeah.
Well, Joe, appreciate your time. Very informative. I think we, you know, enlightened the listeners, if nothing else, a little bit about the USGA and kind of what that looks like and everything. So I appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with us, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Awesome, Clint. Thanks, Chad. And thanks for all that you all do and all your staff and all the volunteers at the IGA. Again, we couldn't do what we do at the national level without you. So appreciate all the great work and look forward to talking to you guys again down the road.
Thanks, right. Joe.
Take care.